From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the opening sentence of her memoir about growing up during the Holocaust, Ruth Kluger writes, "It was death, not sex, that the grown-ups were talking about." On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kluger about growing up in Nazi-occupied Vienna and in concentration camps. Her memoir, Still Alive, was first published in Germany, where it won the Heinrich Heine Prize and the Thomas Mann Prize. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Wittgenstein's Poker, about a momentous philosophical debate between the three eminent philosophers of the 20th century that resulted in the brandishing of a red-hot poker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. Connecticut's governor says a woman who is more than 90 years old is suspected of having inhalation anthrax. The woman is in serious condition at a Connecticut hospital. Governor John Rowland says health officials don't know how the woman came in contact with anthrax spores. The FBI is investigating the case, and the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta is conducting additional tests. Traces of anthrax spores have been found in the offices of two more U.S. senators. Officials believe the spores found in the mailrooms of Senators Edward Kennedy and Christopher Dodd were cross-contamination from letters addressed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. More U.S. Marines may be entering the war in Afghanistan, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The Pentagon has confirmed that a second Marine assault vessel is now in the Arabian Gulf. The USS Bataan joins the USS Peleliu, bringing the number of Marines in the area to as many as 1,600. Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam says the commanding general, Tommy Franks, could use the Marines for traditional warfare or in support of U.S. special operations.
They have the same rules of engagement as the forces who have been in the country operating under, and the forces are available to General Franks to use because the conditions are such that he would like to use them at that time.
The U.S. already has several hundred special forces on the ground in Afghanistan. With the Taliban now confined to two main cities, their main mission is to hunt for Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush today named the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the Justice Department after Robert F. Kennedy, the nation's 64th Attorney General. The move comes at a time when the Bush Justice Department is being criticized for violating civil liberties in its fight against terrorism. NPR's Pam Fessler reports from the White House.
President Bush called Robert Kennedy a good and decent man who was devoted to justice. The president noted Kennedy's commitment to the civil rights movement and to helping the underprivileged, and said his example is an inspiration almost 40 years later.
America today is passing through a time of incredible testing, and as we do so, we admire even more the spirit of Robert Kennedy, a spirit that tolerates no injustice and fears no evil. That's how this country sees him.
But shortly before the naming ceremony, Kennedy's daughter, Carrie Kennedy Cuomo, said her father would not have approved of some steps the Bush administration has taken to fight terrorism. These include secretly detaining individuals for questioning and monitoring discussions between some detainees and their attorneys. Pam Fessler, NPR News, The White House.
In the Afghan city of Kunduz, the Northern Alliance has given the Taliban 3 days to surrender the city or face renewed fighting and bloodshed. Taliban commanders have asked the UN to help negotiate the unconditional surrender of their forces in the city, but the UN turned down the request. On Wall Street, the Dow was off 75 points to close at 99.01, the Nasdaq fell 53 points, and the S&P 500 was down 8. This is NPR News in Washington. The Los Angeles Police Department has a huge backlog of unresolved citizen complaints. That's according to the first report issued by the monitor appointed to oversee reform of the department. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
There were roughly 6,000 complaints lodged against members of the Los Angeles Police Department last year, and the failure to deal with the complaints in a timely way contributes to low morale on the force and undermines the department's ability to implement reforms, according to the report by Michael Cherkasky, a former New York City prosecutor. He was appointed by a judge to check the LAPD's compliance with a federal consent decree. Cherkasky also found that while most officers supported reform, there were a small number who believe that the areas they police are, quote, enemy territory, and that the 1991 beating of Rodney King was handled appropriately. A spokesman for the police department said it was heartening to see that the vast majority of officers supported reform. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
American Airlines says it will pay $25,000 plus funeral and transportation costs to families of each passenger killed last week in the crash of Flight 587. The airline says some 175 checks have been sent so far. The plane crashed minutes after takeoff from New York's Kennedy Airport. All 260 people on the jet were killed. Five people on the ground also died. The jet was bound for the Dominican Republic when it crashed into a Queens, New York neighborhood. President Bush is prepared to use his authority to block a possible strike by mechanics against United Airlines. The White House says a work stoppage during the holiday season could set back the U.S. economy. The union representing 15,000 United mechanics rejected an offer of arbitration Monday. The two sides will enter a 30-day cooling-off period. I'm Mac Lee, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before you meet my guest, Ruth Kluger, I want to read you an excerpt from the beginning of her new memoir, Still Alive. It's about growing up during the Holocaust in Nazi-occupied Vienna and in concentration camps. She writes, "Their secret was death, not sex. That's what the grown-ups were talking about, sitting up late around the table. I had pretended that I couldn't fall asleep in my bed and begged them to let me sleep on the sofa in the living room. I didn't intend to fall asleep. I wanted to get in on the forbidden news, the horror stories. Some were about strangers, others were about relatives. All were about Jews." Ruth Kluger's memoir has just been published in English by the Feminist Press. The German version won the Heinrich Heine Prize and the Thomas Mann Prize. Kluger was born in Vienna in 1931. She was 10 when she was deported with her mother to Theresienstadt. They were later sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau and to a work camp. She emigrated to the U.S. in 1947. She recently retired from teaching German literature at the University of California at Irvine. Ruth Kluger, the first sentence of your memoir is, "Their secrets were about death, not sex." Why did you choose that as the first sentence?
Well, because kids are interested in sex. I mean, they're interested in that which the grown-ups are not telling them about. And in this case, it turned out to be not what it was with the older children in my family, which would have been sex, but it was about the transports that had started and the rumors about Jews being killed. And it had the same aura of the forbidden, of something that was taboo in the sense that it was unclean. And actually, it's a theme that goes through my book, this combination of death and sex or death and love. It comes up in a later chapter on Theresienstadt, which was a kind of a ghetto, it was called a ghetto, where I learned about children being gassed. It was a rumor, and it was somehow a pornographic rumor. I can't explain it in any other way. This is what death, mass killings felt like when I was a child. They were somehow dirty.
Did you become as interested in death as a lot of young kids become interested in sex?
Yes, I believe I did. And when I became interested in sex, it was still mixed up with this feeling about killing.
And did you want to hear explicit stories about how people were dying in the same way that children, young people, want to hear stories about sex?
I did and I didn't. I think there it goes beyond the sex part, because kids really do want to hear the details. And in the case of mass executions and the like, there comes a point where you don't want to hear more because you get too scared.
Yeah, I get the impression through the book and through your life, you've both been obsessed with hearing more about the Holocaust and hearing more stories of what happened at the same time, really not wanting to hear anymore.
Well, this is mirrored in the fact that I tended and still tend to read a lot about the Holocaust for certain periods of time, and then I drop it completely. I don't want to touch it. I don't want to hear anything about it. I changed the subject. I've done this all my life. It's this back and forth with this particular subject. And maybe I wrote the book because I wanted to get it out on paper and be done with it. Of course, one is never done with it. But at the same time, having written it means that I don't have to talk about it anymore. I've been a witness.
You're the youngest kid in your extended family. How did growing up during the Nazi occupation in Vienna make you different from your siblings and your cousins?
Well, it made me different in the sense that I couldn't do the things that they had been able to do, which was to learn how to ride a bicycle, to swim in the public swimming pool, to go to movies. Of course, Jewish children were not allowed to go to movies. And I couldn't play in parks anymore. I couldn't sit on a bench. In the end, the only place one could play was the Jewish cemetery. And inasmuch as the older children had had a much broader experience of life, I felt separated from them, not only by age, but also by experience. Where normally the lives of children expand, in my case, experience made them contract, and I had nothing left except books in the end.
Jewish kids weren't allowed to go to the movies when you were growing up during the German occupation of Vienna. But you wanted to go see Snow White anyways. You went in knowing that if you were caught, it would be a bad thing, but you really wanted to go. You ended up sitting next to a neighbor who was very pro-Nazi. What happened after the movie?
Well, she got up. Instead of leaving the movie house, she stood there, and she challenged me. She said, "Can't you read? It says that Jews are not allowed to come to this movie house, to the cinema. What are you doing here?" And, of course, I couldn't say that I couldn't read. I was old enough to read. I just stood there. And she scolded me and was angry with me. And she said she would, next time she would go to the police and tell them that I had tried to do something which was forbidden by the state or the city or whatever. And I was completely devastated. I'd never had that kind of a clash with somebody who claimed to be in authority before. And it left a lasting impression on me.
Well, I imagine part of the impression was that a next-door neighbor could hate you so much that they were willing to turn you, a child, into the police.
Well, she was the daughter of the baker next door, where I'd often bought bread and cake.
So you were a customer, even?
Yes, yes, of at least a customer of her mother's.
Now, your father was arrested when you were a girl. He was charged with performing an abortion. Abortion was illegal, plus he performed the abortion on a non-Jewish woman.
Yes.
Were abortions common in Vienna then?
Well, you know, that's only hearsay for me. They were not uncommon, but I like to stick to the things that I remember, to my own story, and this is the story of my father. But they were not uncommon, no. They're not uncommon in any country, whether they're legal or not legal. That's one reason to keep them safe and legal.
After your father got out of prison, he had to flee. You and your mother didn't go with him. He went himself to Italy. What did your mother have to do to help him get out of the country?
Well, she bribed some officials, and she had to sign a paper that she would stay until she had paid a tax, which Jews were required to pay when they left the country. And she couldn't pay this tax because the bank accounts were closed, and they had some real estate which had been taken away from them, and she simply didn't have the money.
You say in your book that you've often wondered why your mother didn't try to get you and she out of the country. Instead, you were trapped there during the occupation. Why do you think she didn't try to get out?
Well, one reason was that she had a son from her first marriage who was in Czechoslovakia with his father. And Czechoslovakia at first seemed safe, but then Hitler marched into Czechoslovakia, and from that point on, she felt she had to have both children. And then she thought she couldn't leave me alone while she was getting her son out of Prague. It doesn't quite make sense. There's a circular argument in this somewhere. But she also didn't have the money. And besides, I've since heard from other refugees that women without men weren't really all that welcome in many countries.
And your father had already
escaped. And my father
had
already left, yeah.
You said that your family fought a lot during the German occupation. and that suffering didn't forge strong bonds. You wrote, that's sentimental rubbish and depends on a false concept of suffering as a source of moral education.
Well, one thing I'm trying to do in this book is to show that we didn't change with these things that happened to us, with these enormities that overwhelmed us. What happened was normal people reacting to abnormal circumstances, a clash between a civilization that was running amok and average housewives, for example. And my feeling is that in many books of this kind, the victims are described as if they weren't quite of the same sort as the readers. And one impetus for writing this book was to correct this. So people who had neurotic relationships with each other continue to have neurotic relationships with each other. I had a neurotic relationship with my mother until she died last year. It never really changed. And there's absolutely no reason why one should think that the concentration camps should have made us better people.
My guest is Ruth Kluger, author of the memoir Still Alive, A Holocaust Girlhood Remembered. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ruth Kluger is my guest, and she's just written a new Holocaust memoir, which is called Still Alive, A Holocaust Girlhood Remembered. How old were you when you were taken away to the concentration camp Theresienstadt?
11. I was 11.
And how were you told that you were leaving home?
My feeling about this period of time is that it lasted 7 years. It lasted from 1938, when Hitler invaded Austria, till 1945, when I was liberated in a Bavarian town. And there was an increasing sense of danger. There was an increasing contraction of possibilities for growth. And there was increasing anti-Semitism, which I experienced on various levels. I had expected to be taken to a camp. There were hardly any Jews left in Vienna. We were among the last, 1942, who were taken away. I didn't feel all that badly about it. Theresienstadt was called a ghetto. And I hoped to see my brother again, the boy whom I've just mentioned who was in Prague. And in fact, he had been there. We had gotten postcards from him. But he had been sent away east, and he was killed in the east. I never saw him there. So, in fact, I hoped to be among people with whom I could talk and children with whom I could play. And in effect, this happened. There were lots of Jews there. There were only Jews there. And I felt among my own kind.
Well, there were a lot of children to be with. And many, many of them were crammed into one room. They were what, like?
That was the horrible part of it. I mean, we were in a small room, 35 of us, and we didn't have enough to eat, and there was an enormous amount of disease. And then there were the transports that took people to the extermination camps. There was all of that. But for a child, it's very hard to live with the kind of isolation I experienced in Vienna. And so there are two sides to my memory of Theresienstadt. One side is of a lot of very, very good people. And in fact, as I say in my book, I'm really a very poor Jew in the sense that I'm skeptical of religious practices and I don't believe in God. But I do feel very Jewish, and the reason is that in this Nazi period, I was brought up by Jews. These were my people. I hardly had contact with anyone else. There's a tendency to think, in the case of child survivors, that they were mostly influenced by the Nazis. And, of course, this is not true. We were brought up by Jews.
In fact, you say that there was that a lot of the intelligentsia, a lot of the Jewish intelligentsia from the area, was in Theresienstadt when you were there.
That's correct. Yes, that's where I first found out what it meant to be a Jewish intellectual, and I was enchanted. There were teachers, there were artists, there were people who performed plays, all of which wasn't permitted.
Did any of them become teachers for you? Were you able with them or learn from them?
I had a chance to meet some well-known people, but the people who had the most influence on me, the most profound influence, were unknown teachers who talked to us and young socialists and Zionists who died later on, who told us the rudiments of their beliefs. Whether socialist or Zionist, those were the main currents there. And I became an ardent Zionist, but those were not well-known people in that sense.
After spending some time in Theresienstadt, you were sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau, the concentration camp, death camp. And you had to go through the selection process. What were the Nazis selecting for?
Well, we had been in Auschwitz for a while when the selection came. That was not the selection that one mostly hears about, the one that took place at the ramp. But after we had been in the camp and knew what was going on, or at least those who didn't close their eyes knew that you were going to be killed there. And my mother, who was, I might as well put it bluntly, she was paranoid. And this was a time when horror of governmental proceedings caught up with her very personal paranoia, and she believed it immediately. We're going to be killed here, so we have to get out. The Nazis at that time were selecting workers for their munitions factories, and they wanted women between 15 and 45. And I was 12. My mother was the right age. So she said, you're going to go there and say that you're 15. And I said, I'm not going to do this. I'm 12 years old. You want to add 3 years to my life, and that's a third of my life. I'm not going to do this. I was undeveloped. I was nowhere near puberty. And so I still went, and I said I was 13. I did give her this 1 year. And was turned down. And I came out, and she said, you go in again, you say that you're 15. And there was a second line, and I thought I could try it in that second line where there was another SS man selecting. From pictures I've seen later on, I think it was Dr. Mengele, but I'm not sure, and it doesn't really matter. And so I stood in this line, and the young woman came up to me, who was the scribe or the assistant of the selecting officer, and she was a prisoner like us. And she came up to me and she said, how old are you? And I said, 13. And she said, tell him you are 15. And I took her advice where I hadn't taken my mother's advice, and I said 15, and she added, as the SS man looked rather doubtful, she added, she looks strong, she's going to be a good worker. And that's how I got. That's how I was saved. So, on the one hand, it's an accident. On the other hand, I owe my life to a woman who didn't know me, and who cannot have any other reason for doing what she did except that she wanted to help a strange child. And I think this is an absolute act of goodness.
So, once you passed that selection process, and they decided you were well enough and old enough to work, did you work?
Yeah, I worked. I worked as well as I could, or rather I worked a little less well than I could. But I was in a labor camp. I don't think I contributed much to the German war effort. I doubt that any of us did, because none of us, of course, wanted to work. But I worked outdoors. I carried railroad equipment. They were building some kind of a railroad through the woods, and it was very cold. And, of course, I hated it. And I just hoped it would be over. And I got weaker and weaker, and there was less and less to eat. And they evacuated us just in time.
Yeah, you say that at some point You heard that the Russian troops were moving closer to the
camp. We heard them all the time, and we hoped that we could stay. But the Germans didn't allow any of these camps to stay without evacuation.
So what they were doing then, I think, is evacuating camps and moving people from one camp to another. They weren't liberating you.
Oh, no, no, no.
And these later became known as death marches.
Death marches, yes. And we escaped. We escaped the first night. Later on, I met some people who were on these death marches to the end. And very few made it. I have my doubts that I would have made it. I wasn't a very strong child, and I was really at the end of my strength. Now, what I haven't said yet is that there were three of us by that time, because my mother had simply adopted another child in Auschwitz. She just said to an orphan girl, come along with us. And this kid, who had been extremely depressed and unhappy and didn't know which way to turn, got a new lease on life to my mother's attention and affection.
What made you and your mother think, this time we get out, this time we try to make an escape?
I think it was me. I mean, my sister says that too. It was me. I said, enough. I don't want any more of this. This is it. It was in the evening. We were walking. I've heard that later on they got on trains and it wouldn't have been possible to escape from a train. But we were walking and it was dark and guards or the SS didn't know where to put us, and they were negotiating with some farmers to give us a barn to sleep in. And I said, let's go, let's go, let's go. And my mother said, let's wait for the next ration. And I said, this is ridiculous, now or never. And somehow I managed to persuade the older people, including my sister Susan, my foster sister Susan, to agree. And then we ran, and somehow we made it. There are lots of little adventures on the way, but we ended up pretending that we were Germans and getting some German IDs. And we got to a Bavarian town. We had been in Silesia. A month later, the Americans came, 2 months later.
Ruth Kluger is the author of the memoir, Still Alive, A Holocaust Girlhood Remembered. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a novel of Sisters by the author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Immigrating to America, we continue our conversation with Ruth Kluger, author of the memoir Still Alive, about growing up during the Holocaust. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Wittgenstein's Poker, about the fateful meeting between three eminent philosophers of the 20th century. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ruth Kluger, author of the memoir Still Alive, about growing up during the Holocaust in Nazi-occupied Vienna and in concentration camps. When Kluger was 10, she and her mother were deported to a concentration camp. They survived Theresienstadt, Auschwitz-Birkenau, and a work camp. After the war, they emigrated to the United States. Kluger recently retired from teaching German literature at the University of California at Irvine. When the war was over, did it bring a sense of relief, or were you kind of too tired, too weak, too sick to feel relief?
There's no time in my life which in retrospect seems as peaceful as the summer of 45 after the war was over. It was as if there had been a tremendous achievement. We are alive, and the sun is shining, and we have enough to eat, and we are not in danger anymore, and life is going to be great. Then after a while, of course, you realized how many had died and that you wouldn't see your family again. And this is when the regrets and the sorrow sets in and the kind of mourning begins that has no conclusion, because you don't know when they died, where they died, how they died. There are no grave sites that you can visit.
And for you, you knew that your father died and your brother died.
Yes, those two. And again, for a long time I waited, and my mother, of course, waited maybe all her life, that they would. I waited and hoped they would come back, and almost felt resentful that they weren't here yet. And then there's a sense that. There's a sense of what is known as survivor's guilt, that why am I alive if they are not? But on the other hand, I didn't feel I should have died. I was glad to be alive. So those feelings clash.
You emigrated to the United States with your mother and with your foster sister. As you say, you'd never been to high school or even graduated elementary school, but because of the war, you emotionally belonged to an older generation. How old were you when you got to the United States?
16. I came on my 16th birthday.
How did you compare it to the 16-year-olds you were meeting in the United States?
You know, I didn't meet all that many 16-year-olds. I had passed some examinations at the German high school, I think maybe partly because my mother put some pressure on the principal, and my mother was working for the military government. In any case, I had a high school certificate. And I went to Hunter College with that, and they accepted me. They accepted anybody, you know, talking about open universities. They just took us, and if we did okay during the first semester, they kept us on. And we worked hard. There were a number of us who were there. So I never went to high school. In fact, I never went to elementary school since the Nazis threw us out after the first couple of years or so.
How did you catch up?
I don't know. I never did catch up. You know, there's so many gaps in my knowledge. But I read a lot of books, and I know the books that I read. I don't know the vast fields of knowledge that most people know a little bit about.
Did you try to transform yourself when you moved to America?
I think I was still kind of rebellious, and I didn't like the way girls were treated in those days, which was... They have to conform a lot, much more than nowadays. And I didn't want to conform.
You probably couldn't have conformed. I mean, you were so different.
But, you know, I did things like hitchhike with a bunch of girlfriends. You didn't do that. I mean, nice girls didn't do that.
What else did you do that nice girls didn't do?
I didn't dress the way nice girls did, and I questioned accepted opinion, but that wasn't so difficult in New York. I mean, New York... City colleges, and Hunter College was a city college, were full of people who were in sort of semi-rebellion. But still, the relatives and the contemporaries of my parents who were in New York, they liked to toe the line. They tried to persuade themselves that they were Americans and nothing else. And I couldn't quite do this. I had too much of Europe in me. Maybe also because I couldn't emigrate in 1945 when I would have been 14 and had to stay another 2 years. And at that time, of course, I had a lot to do with the German population, and I also read a lot more German books. And German culture became part of me.
It seems like it would have been so false if you had tried to be an American 16-year-old who hadn't seen the world and who had just lived in the neighborhood. I mean, you had been through such hell.
Yes, but
for 7 years.
But nobody acknowledged that. They were happy to acknowledge it in the case of grown-ups. But with children, I think that Jews in New York at that time had a guilt feeling different from the guilt feeling one felt towards the dead, but a sense that they should have done something for us, that they should somehow have protected us, or that this shouldn't have happened. So what you did with that kind of feeling is to repress it by pretending it hadn't happened. So there was a sense that, yes, my mother suffered, but since I was a child, I couldn't have suffered all that much.
The Holocaust made some survivors more committed, more observant in terms of Judaism, and turned other survivors into atheists or agnostics, in some cases really angry atheists, you know, really angry that that if there was a God, that this could have happened. How did surviving the Holocaust affect your sense of your Jewishness?
Well, I came out of a so-called emancipated family that is not assimilated. We were emancipated in the sense that we weren't kosher, but not assimilated in the sense that anybody ever pretended they were not Jewish. My father was a Zionist, though not enough to take us to Palestine. So I don't come from an Orthodox family, but I believed in God as a child. In fact, in Auschwitz, I believed he should save me because of who I was. And later on, that belief in a deity kind of evaporated. I think I would have been an agnostic in any case, and the Holocaust accelerated that process.
You're right, you believe in ghosts, but not in God.
Well, that's a bit metaphorical, of course. I don't expect ghosts to come in the door. But I do believe that that there's a presence of people one has known and whom one doesn't anymore perceive as full entities, but rather as memories.
Do you feel like since you've been a child, you've lived in the presence of the dead?
Since the end of the war, yes. And they don't go away. That's why I say they're ghosts. You know, they have a sort of transparency which living people don't have, but they're there.
Well, here's a related question. I know some people, when they feel that they are persecuted, as the Jews certainly were when in Eastern Europe when you were a child, that persecution makes them more of what it is that they're being persecuted for, makes them more Jewish, or whatever the subject of their persecution is, and for that, for some people, that means becoming more religious.
That's correct. Yes, and I've seen that happen. When I was in Auschwitz, I did at one point pray, and I believed in God, and I thought He would or should save me. Later on, when I was in the dark, very sick, and I thought I would die of a heart disease, I thought to myself, it really, truly doesn't matter whether I live for another year. I was not afraid of death, and I was not, and I didn't believe in God. And I just felt it's a good thing that fear of death, in my case, was only a childhood's disease. I haven't had it since.
When the war ended, as you point out, there was no name for the Holocaust yet. People weren't calling it the Holocaust. When the word Holocaust was applied to what happened to Jews in Eastern Europe, did that help at all, having a name
for
what you experienced?
It helps a lot to have a name for anything. That's why I don't really care whether you call it Holocaust or Shoah or any other word that describes this particular catastrophe. If you just call it the German pogrom, then you compare it with other pogroms and it becomes diffuse. And if you say the mass murder of the Jews in Germany, then you haven't got a handle on it. You can't really talk, say, about Holocaust literature. We really need a word. We need a word for anything that we perceive as an entity.
My guest is Ruth Kluger, author of the memoir Still Alive, A Holocaust Girlhood Remembered. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ruth Kluger. Her memoir, Still Alive, is about growing up during the Holocaust in Nazi-occupied Vienna and in concentration camps. You have two sons.
I have two sons.
What kind of childhood did you want them to have? 7 years of your childhood was spent during the Holocaust.
Of course, I wanted a normal childhood for them, a normal American childhood. They didn't even learn German because I wasn't interested in teaching them. And by the time I got to be interested in teaching them, they didn't want it. Basically, they knew very little about my childhood. I didn't hide anything, but I didn't urge it on them either, so that they knew the story of our escape. But that was in the March of 50s, and when they went to school and said, my mother escaped from a German prison camp, the boy said, ha-ha, they've been seeing Stalag. They said, your father, okay, but your mother? So that they weren't even sure whether I was telling them something that had really happened. Later on, of course, they got more interested, but we all tell our children either too much or too little. For example, Spiegelman, the author of Maus, clearly indicates his father talked too much about it. And other survivors' children have had the same experience. My children tend to say I told them too little, but I don't know how you can satisfy your children ever.
Why did you go in that direction, though, of saying a little rather than a lot?
It was difficult to talk about it. It continued to be difficult to talk about until I actually sat down and started writing. I taught Holocaust literature for many years at Princeton and in California, and the students often asked me to talk about my own experiences, and I found it almost impossible. It was really a question of sitting down and compressing experience in such a way that it would also include the filter of memory. The filter of memory gives it some distance, but if you just describe events, as is done in much of oral history, you end up with something that makes me quite uncomfortable.
Why?
Because it's stripped. It's stripped of meaning. I think you shouldn't write about anything or talk about anything that you can't add some meaning to. That you shouldn't write about anything that you don't have something to say about.
I think that and the fact that you write really well is what makes your memoir a very literary book.
Well, I thank you for that compliment.
Your book was first published in Germany. How many years ago?
9 years ago.
What reaction did you get in Germany?
Well, first of all, I wrote it because I had made some friends in Germany. I was there with some American students as their director. I'd made friends with Germans who knew a lot about the Holocaust and who didn't mind talking about it, but I felt they still didn't understand that we were normal people clashing with abnormal circumstances. There tends to be something like a barbed wire curtain analogous to the Iron Curtain when you talk about the Holocaust. And I thought I could write for these people and add a few nuances or shadings to what they already knew. It got some rave reviews, and then it took off, and it became a very popular book in Germany. Maybe also because once you start thinking about it, there aren't as many survivor accounts written in German, originally written in German, as there are in other languages. That could be one reason. But it somehow hit a nerve, and I became fairly well known in Germany.
You're 70 now, but your book is written from the perspective of a girl living through the experiences, but you're a mature woman reflecting back on those experiences. Did you want to get into the same frame of mind that you were in when you were a child living through this as you wrote the book?
Partly. Some passages are written from a girl's point of view, but then other passages are written from the adult's point of view. That's what I meant before when I talked about the filter of memory. I think if there's anything special about the organization of this book is that it tells a story and then it adds a reflection of the mature woman.
There's a part in the book when you're in, I think this is when you're in Auschwitz, and you're getting your serial number tattooed onto your arm. And as it's right after you get the tattoo, you say to yourself, okay, this is kind of exhilarating in a way because now I know I'm living through something really important. I am an eyewitness to something very, very important. What was it like to be a girl thinking about the importance of this? I mean, I'm sure what was primarily on your mind was how frightened you were.
No, not really, because, you know, if you think of being a witness, you also think that you're going to get out of this.
To bear witness.
To bear witness, yeah. You're projecting the future. Now I'm here, but then I'll be among normal people telling them this mad story. So this is a way of saving your sanity. You don't think of yourself in the gas chamber going up in the flames that you could see in Auschwitz at night, and during the day you saw smoke coming out of the smokestacks. You don't think of yourself in this situation. You think of yourself in another situation where people are going to listen to you even though you're only a child. Most people thought of themselves as future witnesses. And the question you just asked has been asked of me before precisely by people who doubt that the child would think in this way. But it's...
Well, did you have a sense then that you would be a writer? Did you have a sense...
I wanted to be a poet. I wanted to be a lyric poet. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have to be a writer, a creative writer. You could be a journalist or whatever. The main thing was that hope crystallized in the idea of bearing witness.
Well, Ruth Kluger, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ruth Kluger's memoir, Still Alive, A Holocaust Remembered, has just been published in English. We're going to hear a passage from the recording Chamber Music from Theresienstadt. The string trio was written by Gideon Klein in 1944 while he was held in Theresienstadt. 9 days after he finished this piece, he was sent to Auschwitz. He died 3 months later at the age of 26. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Wittgenstein's Poker. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The pen is mightier than the sword, or so the old saying goes. But on one notorious night in 1946, an eminent philosopher found himself backing up his sharp words with a sharp weapon. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the new book, Wittgenstein's Poker.
It's another one of those great moments in 20th century intellectual history that I wish I hadn't missed. On a raw October evening in 1946, the Cambridge University Moral Science Club, which is a still-functioning discussion group for philosophy professors and their students, held a meeting. The guest speaker was Karl Popper, whose now famous book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, a fierce critique of Plato, Freud, and totalitarianism, had just been published. In the distinguished overflow crowd that night was the aged Bertrand Russell, the radical political activist and the Western world's most famous living philosopher. Also present in the crowd was Popper's nemesis, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the man hailed by many of his peers as the most brilliant philosopher of his time. This was the one and only meeting, or perhaps I should say collision, of the three eminent philosophers, and though it took place in a room filled with men whose profession was to discern the nature of truth, few then present agreed on who said what and the order in which the fateful events transpired. The most plausible version of the meeting goes like this. Popper began his talk, which was entitled, Are There Philosophical Problems? Within seconds, Wittgenstein, as was his custom at lectures, began to loudly and furiously interrupt Popper. Popper popped off too, and then the enraged Wittgenstein grabbed a red-hot poker from the room's fireplace and brandished it in Popper's direction. Some fellow philosophers, ordinarily not called upon to be men of action, tried to intervene. Wittgenstein stormed out of the room and slammed the door. Someone in the audience, trying to restore civility, asked Popper to give an example of a moral rule, and Popper wittily replied, not to threaten visiting lecturers with pokers. The whole debacle took less than 10 minutes. Wittgenstein's Poker, an extremely likable and smart first book by BBC journalists David Edmonds and John Idenow, educates us readers into an appreciation of what the big fuss was all about. The tone of their book is absolutely perfect. Edmonds and Idenow don't condescend to their subjects by turning Popper and Wittgenstein into kooky scholarly caricatures. Nor do they overstate the case for the importance of the philosophical face-off. After all, the sun still rose the next morning, and most people in the world, then and now, wouldn't know Wittgenstein from Einstein. But as Edmonds and Idenow explain in entertaining and lucid fashion, what was at stake in the battle of brains that night was the ultimate purpose of philosophy, whose contemporary history they elegantly summarize. Popper, to simplify shamelessly, was a big idea man. He thought philosophy should tackle the problem of knowledge and the moral dilemmas of freedom. His lasting influence, as Wittgenstein's Poker demonstrates, has been on businessmen, scientists, and politicians. Václav Havel and the Dalai Lama are among his fans. Wittgenstein, very waywardly following in Bertrand Russell's footsteps, thought that puzzling over the problem of language was an end in itself. And he went on to avow that words are autonomous from the world of objects they're supposed to refer to. Wittgenstein has won the legacy battle hands down. Postmodernist art and theory are indebted to him, and he's often placed in a category with literary master surgeons of language like Gertrude Stein and Samuel Beckett. In addition to both men's fundamental contempt for the work the other was doing, their common nationality, religious background, and bullying argumentative style forecast that their meeting at Cambridge would be tempestuous. Wittgenstein's Poker expands outward to describe what life was like for Viennese Jewish families, like the Poppers and the Wittgensteins, in the early decades of the 20th century. The book also naughtily revels in detailing both philosophers' awful personalities. The oracular Wittgenstein evoked fear in his worshipful students and even mesmerized a few of them into abandoning philosophy for factory work. He said of fellow philosopher and mentor G.E. Moore that the man was living proof of how far one could get in life with absolutely no intelligence whatsoever. Popper was no Sonny Jim either. Colleagues said of him that he was so intellectually intolerant that his great book should have been called The Open Society by One of Its Enemies. At our own moment in history, when academic careers, at least in American universities, are determined by student evaluations, and when the big draw at my own university this semester was an evening of discussion with Billy Joel, reading Wittgenstein's Poker made me feel wistful. I don't even want to imagine what Wittgenstein and Popper, both refugees from Hitler's Austria, would think of my nostalgia for their good old days.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Wittgenstein's Poker by David Edmonds and John Idenow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by pianist Tommy Flanagan. He died Friday at the age of 71 after having an arterial aneurysm. His funeral will be held tomorrow. For about 20 years, Flanagan played with Ella Fitzgerald, and for many of those years, he was also her music director. In 1993, he dedicated an album to her. From the recording Lady Be Good for Ella, this is How High the Moon.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years, and Vintage Books, paperback publishers of The True History of the Kelly Gang, the new novel by Peter Carey. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stephen Bernstein, founder of the jazz band Sex Mob. Their new CD is a tribute to the music from James Bond films. Also, Ken Wells tells us about growing up on the Louisiana Bayou, hunting snakes, and eating squirrel stew. He has a new novel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.